Okay, well, welcome everybody. Today we have a couple of authors. We've not done an author podcast before, so this is our inaugural effort in this vein. And just to give you a little background, what we try to do is we get lots of offers to review books, and we know lots of people who write books. And so we also do book reviews through the Qualitative Report. And we some books I think we like more than others. And so what we wanted to do today was to have a conversation. Dan Wolf was with me as well. And we want to talk with a couple of authors of a book that we like very well. And that book is called Collaborative Qualitative Research. It's a new book, the second book from these authors. And so what we're going to do is we're going to introduce ourselves, and then we'll go and ask a couple of questions. What we want to try to do is to, normally when we do a book review, we try to approach the book review as if we're qualitative researchers. And so one of the things we like to do is to introduce who we are and as reviewers and where we're coming to from our review. Is this the first qualitative research book we've ever read? Are we new to the field, or have we been around the block a couple of times? And that, and just as a researcher, it's important to know what relationship you have with the authors and so forth and that. And then we rather than sort of say, okay, chapter one, chapter two, you know, that sort of thing, is we try to take a step back a little bit, and just like you would say what your findings were from a qualitative research study, this is data to us. We've read it through, we've looked at it, and then we kind of talk about what our takeaways are from it, but also with the idea that this is going to be heard, or in the case of a book review in the journal, read by others. And we hope that we can give you some insights in terms of how to, you know, how this book can help you. You know, our tagline is "Where the world comes to learn qualitative research." And so we find, whether it's our articles or the books review, it's always with that intent, is how this could be useful for others. And so this book, we'll talk more about it, but the collaborative qualitative research is rather unique. The authors will tell you about that a little bit in terms of the approach that they've taken about how to conduct and how to report qualitative research. That's one of the things that appealed to us. So I'm Ron Chennai, and I'm the co-editor-in-chief of the Qualitative Report. And I've been doing a lot of years, and I also teach students how to do qualitative research. And I usually tell them that they need about three books. I don't want to shock these students that they have to read a lot. But I say, you know, about three books. Maybe that won't do you too much. And maybe one is like an intro to qualitative research. And then maybe one might be more methodologically, you know, like if you're interested in grounded theory, maybe this is a nice handbook of grounded theories that you can take a look at. But eventually you want to kind of get into one, a Charmaz or whomever, that can kind of be your guide through that, especially your first one in that. And so I think, as we'll talk about this, I think this book maybe probably should be in that sequence as well. And so I'm excited to talk more about it, and I'm going to turn it over to Dan, introduce himself, and then we'll introduce Thalia and Raji.
Okay. Hi, I'm Dan Wolf, a retired professor of social work at the University of Calgary. A longtime participant with the Qualitative Report, starting as a reviewer and an author and editor, now co-editor-in-chief. So this has become a passion for me to be involved in initiative like TQR that's trying to embrace authors and to help people present their material in ways that could be shared widely in the world. So the TQR is worldwide read. Authors from over 100 countries have participated. And so we're really interested in that kind of collaboration. So coming across your book, your new book, Collaborative Qualitative Research, was really kind of a breath of fresh air. I'm working on a book review for it now. I'm a practitioner and a researcher. So I'm always reading research books as if, could this be useful to a practitioner? Could this be something that is more than just a research book? And I found that to be the case in your book. So I'm anxious to talk with you more about some of these ideas that have stood out for me as being quite exciting. So maybe it'd be good for me now to say that we have with us Thalia Mulvihill, professor of higher education and social foundations of education at Ball State. and Raji Swaminathan. I think
Swaminathan.
Professor in the Department of Educational Policy and Community Studies in the School of Education at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. So thanks for being with us here today. Maybe I could start off with a question that would just bring you into this a bit. Your book's focus on collaboration, you know, this is the possibilities that are out there of being collaborative is immense. And a lot of times people throw that word around and you don't know exactly what they mean by collaboration. So you guys are co-authors of this book. So could you speak a little bit about your collaborative style as you come together as colleagues and put this book together? Could you talk about collaboration between the two of you in this book?
Yes, we'd be happy to. We want to say thank you also for this invitation to come and be in conversation about this book today. It's a very meaningful invitation to us because the qualitative report community has been so essential to our own ability to think and grow and imagine possibilities for qualitative research. And, you know, Raji and I, we met each other, Raji, over 30 years ago as doctoral students at Syracuse University, pursuing information around cultural foundations of education. It was a very interdisciplinary doctoral program, a full complement of social sciences. And we had tremendous mentors and people who were prodding us to do the deep reading and to have practice in the craft. And Raji and I found ourselves often being centered around similar provocative questions that we jointly held curiosity about. So I think one of the dimensions about our collaboration that I've held on to, Raji, for all these years is the curiosity that we share. This also probably speaks to the passion that we have about educating next generation of qualitative researchers, which we're both engaged in. So collaboration has remained sort of an open, multivocal kind of concept for us, and it has shown up in our writing, in our own carrying out of research projects, but also in our teaching. So Raji, what would you say? Yeah.
So I would agree. So here's the thing, you know, I was from India, so it's a very different. I was an international student at Syracuse University, and it was a very different world. And learning from my colleagues was and my peers was very informative, interesting, and a very friendly place as well. So when Athalia says that we've had this collaboration for a long time and it is around curiosity, I think curiosity is a very good way to put it, because I was intensely curious about everything that I saw, the schools that I went to, how different they were. I had been a teacher in India, but in a very in a holistic kind of background with a holistic school. So it was very different to come in and see things. And I had the opportunity and very good mentors who put me straight away in three different schools. And I went in to do qualitative research in three different places. And it was great to be able to discuss with Thalia and have this back and forth conversation about what I saw, how I interpreted something, and how we could then dialogue and question each other around our own assumptions around what we heard or saw and understood. And so I think that is very much the kind of collaboration. And for that matter, I think it carries over into our teaching. Very often I ask students to share what they have written with each other so that they can build one on the one, one can, you know, offer comments and feedback, and then it ends up being a better product. So even if they are not doing the same product, they still collaborate in helping each other grow. So I think it comes up in our teaching a great deal as to how one can be I think because students often ask about competition, and the concept of competing with rather than against is something that we often, I think, talk about with our students. So that's how I think our collaboration has also grown along with, I think, a friendship that has also grown alongside it.
Well, I guess I do need to note that you have also done a book on teaching qualitative research. It's one of the about five books you collaborated on. Is that, it was my numbers right?
I think that's about right, and counting.
Right.
So it must be working. Must be working.
So do you have another book that's in the making right now as we speak?
We do actually have a couple. Raji and I often talk about the writing process and the research process like breathing. It's like we must do it. Mm-hmm. And it's not just part of our job description, but it is the way in which we engage in a continuous learning process. So we have often stages of writing in book projects and journal articles and book chapters. So once we celebrate the liftoff of one, thankfully we're turning next to the other projects. Yeah,
that's a good way to organize. We have a thing each year at Nova Southeastern on, it's called Power Publishing Day. I don't know why that's called that. And so they usually ask me to do a kind of a 15-20 minute intro. And this year, you all should probably give me the presentation, not me. It's about how to create, it's called Meta to the Madness. And it's about creating a writing publishing plan. You definitely see it more Australia, Europe, you see that. I don't see it as much in terms of training faculty here, but the notion that you got to plan these things and you have to plan for rewrites and those sorts of things. And obviously when you're doing a book, you have to plan for the cover and the galley and all those kinds of things. And you can sometimes get caught short and got another revision, but you're so tight going forward. And you all seem to have a really good way of managing that. I think that's another probably value to the collaboration is that you can always work with each other in terms of who's going to pick up what part and that. And I just finished a collaborative edited book, and we had to do that too, because I go to a lot of meetings. It takes a lot of time, and you got to be able to have that flexibility. I think that's probably one of the strengths of your relationships.
Absolutely. And, sometimes the literature refers to as the accountability partner. I think one of the things that Raji and I, given the fact that we've had the benefit of working together for so long, is in fact, we know how to give feedback to one another, just not the what. So it knowing how to be sensitive to one another's busy times or unexpected things that happen in our day job, and figuring out how to stay comfortably making the timelines related to a research project has taken some fine tuning. I think that the feedback we give one another at different stages of a project is really helpful in that way. But planning is key. And so are the tools that one uses to accomplish. We've adopted many of the Google Drive, Google Docs tools that are available that work well for us. Mm-hmm. But I think authors and researchers have to experiment a bit to figure out what tools they need to be able to bring forward the kinds of work they're working on.
The collaboration that you talk about in your book is wide-ranging. It's not only about professionals working with one another, as you've been describing, but it also talks about something that a lot of researchers think about when they think of collaboration, and that is working with the people who are part of your study, the communities, the people that you interview. And so one of the tensions when you widen the participation of your study to include things like PAR or other kinds of indigenous practices is you get more and more citizens of the community becoming involved. And one of the things that you said, a quote that I have written down, was how does one foster collaborations while also holding research to methodological rigor? This need to kind of conform to a certain extent to certain practices of doing research, but you still want to be relevant to the people in the communities who you're enlisting to work with you. Could you say a little bit more about that tension and some thoughts you may have about how to hold both of those up in value?
Yeah, thank you for raising that tension. Words have power and they change meaning over time. And the word rigor has been used in its positive connotation in order to help establish a set of criteria related to quality. But it has also been used as a dagger to try to dismantle confidence in certain types of research. And I think qualitative research over a long period of time has seen that word used in various ways. Mm-hmm. So for our project, one of the things that we wanted to point to, especially for early career researchers just getting introduced into this community, is to help them with the discourse and the changing nature of the terminology that we encounter, but also talk about this very important concept about quality and quality frameworks and how one makes evaluative judgments about the usefulness of research. And certainly when you situate that in a collaborative project where in fact your epistemology and your philosophy of engagement with your participants is particular, and that you are forming relationship and you are in fact helping to facilitate an environment under which many people are contributing to the project of creating new knowledge. Certain sensitivities need to also accompany that and reconfigure, change the way we evaluate something called rigor throughout a project. So Raji and I were very intentional when we challenged each other often in this writing process about what version of this did we want to focus on and why we thought it would be useful.
Kind of rigor versus rigor mortis.
Thank you. Yes.
That's a good way to put it. I think also we were trying to help early career researchers understand the pretty obvious power differentials that can occur in the field, but also that the product or the outcome of the research might be very different in the sense the expectation of what the research should produce for participants in the field might be a little bit different from what university researchers mm-hmm. would want from their point of view. So I think that is one of the things that we were trying to get at, that yes, we need to hold collaborations, but methodological rigor does not mean that we are not sensitive to what perhaps a practitioner may want or somebody in the field, a community-based volunteer may want out of the research versus what a university researcher may want. Mm-hmm. So I think that was part of what we were also trying to get at in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was thinking when reading it, it seems that, you have some, strengths or characteristics of these terms we use all the time. So the researcher is the instrument, right? And then it seems like when I look at other types of analytical approaches that seem to be teamwork, it still has a bit of, and I know you talk a lot about epistemologies in your book, it seems a bit, the idea that we're going to come up with a consensual, that there is the one, one outcome versus, I remember reading Writing Culture way back in the day, and Steve Tyler, and he said, well, postmodern, it could be like the Bible. There's four different gospels, and they're reporting on the same event, yet some things are there, some things are not, and they're allowed to stand side by side as four authoritative, four authors. Now we can talk about when they're written, who wrote them, and so forth. But I thought, oh, okay, I get that later. So when you're talking about collaboration in terms of how does, the with the rigor and the quality, how do you talk about the idea that there seems to be a tendency that there has to be the one outcome, which you would get if you're the one researcher?
Yeah, and if we follow that analogy, you know, the King James Version of the Bible had a certain number of stories, but if you talk to theologians who quickly point out that the Gnostic Gospels were left out, you know, you're
a tough editor there, I tell you.
you're always in a space, if you're coming from within a particular epistemology, of realizing the limited nature of any single story or single right. interpretation. And that's difficult sometimes for certain researchers on certain projects, because as humans, I think we like certainty, and holding on to ambiguity can sometimes-
That's what they call it, positivism, because you're positive.
Yes, yes. So I think it takes practice. And I think it takes continued elevated ways of reciprocally communicating with all those who are involved in a project, but it takes practice. I don't think anyone could do it really, really well without multiple false starts and getting feedback and learning how to do that better. But in the versions of collaborative research that we were interested in, we were trying to provide tools and thought prompts and examples of research in the literature that would encourage people to stand with ambiguity a bit longer in their projects than perhaps feels comfortable, but ultimately would produce a greater end.
Yeah.
You also mentioned in your book that when principles of collaboration are used, these are your words, they often change the type of research questions that get used in this study. So could you say a little bit more kind of what's behind that idea that collaborative research may pursue questions in a different way than other forms of research?
Yeah, Raji, maybe you could start.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we were trying to talk about there with regard to principles is that when we, let's say, hold a dialogue or a sense of, you know, communication as one of the principles of collaboration, if we hold that up during the process of coming to research questions, then we do need to start thinking about what kind of research questions should really be pursued mm-hmm. within a collaborative group. And perhaps that at that point, the research question is very likely to change, because depending on who's bringing the first question to the table or who is actually saying, well, here we have gathered around this particular issue or problem, what questions then rise to the top are likely to be a kind of a blend between a person's personal interest in the topic, as well as what is being put on the table. So I think that very often collaborations actually occur around complex problems. So if there are complex issues that we are looking at through collaborations or through a variety of different disciplines and people around the table, each of them is likely to bring a slightly different version of the research question or what is important. And I think it requires a lot of dialogue at that point to really intentionally plan as to what one should first pursue and what makes sense to pursue the next, or, you know, simultaneously perhaps. Mm-hmm. So I think that's really one of the things that we are talking about, that yes, the research question is likely to change, because it may not come just from the, you know, from the university-led researcher, right? So,
The other thing that Raji and I have found endlessly fascinating is actually troubling the third question and the way it appears within the research methodological literature. We're all familiar with research questions, interview questions, sometimes the reflexivity kinds of questions that we employ. But I think that in our conversations over a good number of years, we've been fascinated by where questions show up, in what form they show up, who's the originator of these questions, and how do they function at all stages of a study. And one of the benefits of troubling that is allowing us to then open up who gets to decide what the research question or questions are that are really driving any study. And in traditional approaches, we have a lot of good ways that researchers go at that. They try to be very well informed about the literature that's come before to help shape that. Observations and experiences, both individually and collectively in spaces, sometimes shape that. But often those pieces of the labor are so extensive that that's where it stops. So we've found benefit in rolling those questions over differently and trying to help people design questions in a study that will be connecting throughout the arc of the process. And it opens things up, at least in our experience. We have found it really opens things up to additional possibilities for impact of any singular study, but also finding new ways to connect studies that seemingly are independent to one another in a more synergistic way.
Well, it seems like that you're talking about a set of skills of, you use the word dialogue and have conversations and blend ideas and become bigger than when you started. It sounds like researchers from this point of view need to have excellent interpersonal skills to be able to negotiate and listen very carefully to one another. And to so that sounds like a non-technical set of skill set that really is necessary to kind of make collaboration thrive. And not everybody maybe has that. Maybe that's difficult for some people to kind of, you know, play nicely with others, you know, or to kind of let their ideas take a second place maybe to someone else's.
Yeah, I think your observation is right on mark, Dan. And it may be, you know, for example, we know Ron's background and we know all of the skills that he brings forward as a communicator. And it's very evident that that has an impact in how he thinks about research and the studies that he conducts, and then how he teaches. So if we were to examine sort of the background of each scholar and ask whether or not they're on the scale at the high end with the interpersonal skills and communication, I think that would tell us something about not only the results of the study, but how everyone involved in a study actually feels about the process that they're engaged in. The other related question that we often get is, you know, are these skills really something that people can learn? Can you teach this? With experience, do people always get better? Well, they're never absolutes, so I don't think the answer is yes to all of that. But I do think if we modify the pedagogies that are at use in university programs, for example, we have a better opportunity to broaden the skill set and the sensibilities that people put to use in the field and how they're working through projects. So in the book, we've done our best with what we've tried and, you know, examining some of the things that didn't work, the things that did, to say, here are some ways that scholars and researchers might help themselves as they're trying to build their skill set to do this really important and incredibly unique set of skills that need to come together to do it well. And I know, Raji, you've thought a lot about this in particular.
Yes, because I feel like just the way, you know, that we teach interview skills in a qualitative research classroom, or, you know, or observation skills, that we should intentionally get students, and perhaps even as, you know, as researchers, we should intentionally practice how do we figure out how to talk with each other around collaboration and learn some of the skills of collaboration as we go along. So I think that is, that's something, yes, I do believe quite strongly in that. And in my own teaching, I try to get students to work together in groups and think about how they would give feedback to each other even, or how, what can they do in order to jointly create a one piece of work. And what are the problems they face when they are trying to come to an agreement, and how do they resolve these disagreements that they might have? So I think you're absolutely right in saying that a lot of this has to do with some of the skill set in negotiating. And if we really think about it, it's something we've taken for granted in qualitative research, because even when I enter a field, I'm constantly negotiating my access in the field. And it's not just at the beginning. It is right through that particular access is renegotiated even as I become more and more part of a community. So I think I think what you just pointed out is really important.
I think it impacts the models of scholarship. You know, in the university setting, doctoral programs by and large are still reliant upon the single author dissertation. Mm-hmm. There are some nice innovative differences there. And I think another really good example is how the editorial team at TQR, the yes. philosophy that they use in interacting with scholars who are in the writing process. So publishing models and dissertation models and other scholarship venues are in need of a revolution of sorts, if in fact collaboration will be a valued way to approach studies in the future.
One of the issues that we have at TQR is because we're international, we have many authors who send their work in from countries where English is not the first language. And so we've got really challenged by how do we deal with that? Does everything have to go through English? How do we respond to authors who are doing their best to speak in a language that's not their first language? And so there's, I just think what it would be like for me to write an article in Chinese, you know, and how difficult that would be. So we use software help. We have reviewers who speak these other languages, but it's a chronic issue, and we become part of the hegemony of English, you know, in this field. Do you have some thoughts about possible ways to be more collaborative with researchers and writers whose first language is not English?
Yeah, well, I must say that. When I attended the 2021 TQR conference, I was so impacted by Ron's keynote address that was addressing some of these issues. And for me, it was the first time that I had an opportunity to think more deeply about that impact. So thanks, Ron, for sparking that. But I do believe that it is an obligation now. Now I believe it's an obligation for us as a scholarly community to be thinking more decisively about how we can open up the exchange and not let language be a barrier. And, you know, there are different discourse communities that, you know, that we are allowing ourselves to be absent from. And the language, barriers can diminish all of us if we're not actively trying to engage it. The technology around that, I imagine, is still more clunky than not for what it is we have in our imagination, to be better. But I so appreciate that TQR is taking the lead. And there's only one other journal that I read regularly that has multiple languages regularly displayed, and it's given me a lot of important things to think about.
Yeah.
It's a challenge when all the different notions of translation, when someone has interviewed someone in a language other than English, And then you get the, you know, one practice is just to have the original language text from the interview, and then a translated version. And you know, as an editor, you're going, okay, I should I make them all sound like they graduated from, you know, Harvard or Oxford or something like that? And then is that the way that they spoke? Is that the way it's been translated? So it's always that issue, and most I just let it go. And you know, don't assume it's a typo or things like that. So it's a real challenge in terms of that how do you deal with that? But I think what I've tried to do is to start that and to start to challenge myself to be able to you know, try to read in these different languages and then how to write. And then to me, it's been very collaborative working with other members of our editorial board who are native speakers in these languages and ask them, you know, kind of that sort of collaboration. So I didn't start out to be a collaborative, but I recognize my weaknesses or my failings, and then how to, you know, try to help help the author produce the best account that they can. I know we're kind of getting close to the end of our time here. You know, there's so many things that you have been very provocative and really great ideas that, challenge. And I said at the beginning, as far as as a book, you know, how would I place this book? And what I love about it is that you've written this book as much for a teacher of qualitative research as a learner, and hopefully teachers are learners too. You would always hope that. And I think that your book is kind of really is the first two books, because you introduce everyone to a variety of ways of doing the research. You introduce not just the usual narrative, you know, grounded theory. You get the arts-based stuff, the collaborative stuff, which I think is broader than most introductory books, and you get into some how-to stuff. So and so people can start, if they're going to end up doing appreciative inquiry, you let them kind of be critical consumers of a bunch of different methodologies. You give them enough information about appreciative inquiry that they can kind of get into it, and then maybe they're going to hop off, and then the next book will be a specific text or a specific guide along the journey. So I like that your book is both, you know, I think if you're looking about organize how to teach a class, you give a lot of nice structure for that, all the way down to what to read and how to organize. And I really love the idea that students are not going to learn to be collaborative researchers if you don't help them learn this in a collaborative manner. And I think it's a great introduction book for qualitative research in general. The collaborative part's a cool part of it, like a value add to it, but also it was beyond the basic intro to help people get to that next step, as well as all the way through to the writing part. So I really think the book covers a lot of bases for folks in terms of looking for a great resource.
Well, thank you. We appreciate.
Yeah, we really do appreciate that.
Thank you. I'm writing this book review for your book. And I read it a couple times now. There's a phrase that's kind of jumped out at me that right now is the provisional title of what this book review will be called. And it is, research is not innocent. That's really kind of, because I've noticed that in so many ways. You talked about collaborative research practices, trying to stand against positivist, racist, sexist, colonial epistemologies. Right. And over, I just kept hearing that phrase, you know, research is not innocent. And I think that really, for me, kind of captured, you know, my takeaways from this book. And plus, it's chock full of references that I found fascinating. So I've got like 10 articles that you referenced that I've downloaded now to kind of dig more deeply into some of these things. So I think this, as Ron said, I think this is a big contribution to the field. And thought it was great that we had a chance to talk about some of these themes. I have many more questions, but we don't have time. But it's been very stimulating, and we really want to appreciate you taking time to talk with us.
Well, thanks, Dan. It was a privilege for us to be in your presence and with Ron and Adam's help. So we're really grateful.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I echo that sentiment. Yes.